This is Solve It for Kids.
Hello, my amazing and curious friends. My name is Jennifer, and this is Solve It for Kids, the podcast that gives kids and families a peek inside the real world of scientists, engineers, and experts as they solve problems in their jobs using creativity, cooperation, and critical thinking. And now please welcome to the show my podcast partner, Galactic Space Geek, Jeff Gagne.
Hello, Jennifer. I am happy to be here today for another episode, and today we are going to get wet.
Ooh, this sounds so interesting. What problem are we solving today?
Can you predict which animals will survive environmental change?
Can you predict which animals will survive environmental change? Ooh, this sounds like an interesting and important question. Who's our guest today, Jeff?
So today, our guest is Dr. Katie Lauterhouse. She is an associate professor of marine and environmental sciences. But let me simplify that. She is a marine biologist, so we're going to get wet talking about crustaceans.
Oh, cool. Welcome to the show, Dr. Katie.
Thanks, everyone. I'm excited to be here.
Well, we are excited because we're going to talk about which animals will survive environmental change. And I know, isn't this a cool topic to be talking about with kids and parents and people of all ages? Because it's really important.
It's really important, especially in the ocean. Right now, marine species are threatened by warming and ocean acidification. Have you guys heard about ocean acidification?
No. I know a little bit about it, but yes, let's go over that.
Ocean acidification happens when carbon dioxide from the atmosphere diffuses into the ocean. So when we burn fossil fuels, we're adding carbon dioxide to the atmosphere, and that means we're also adding carbon dioxide to the ocean. And when it does that, it interacts with other water molecules, and this causes a cascade of chemical reactions. And it upsets the balance of ions in the ocean. So there are hydrogen ions that are in water, and they get released when carbon dioxide interacts with water. And this makes the ocean more acidic. The same thing happens when soda is made. We add carbon dioxide to water, and that also makes the soda more acidic.
Acidic like lemons, right?
Yep.
So kids can think of something really acidy like that.
That's right.
I didn't know that's what it was called, ocean acidification.
Yeah, and some people mistakenly believe it's from acid rain, but it's not. It's from carbon dioxide.
Ooh. Okay, right. Yeah. And carbon dioxide is that same major problem with pollution in the air atmosphere, so Earth's actual atmosphere that we talk so much about, even kids know about it, but I don't think we really connect it too much with that same problem is causing a problem in the oceans.
That's right. And it's sometimes called the other climate change problem because it's not talked about as much as global warming is. But the more acidic ocean is a problem for marine life because a lot of marine life makes shells. So, you know, just like people have skeletons, you know, marine life also has a skeleton, but there's skeletons on the outside and we call it a shell. And so as the ocean becomes more acidic, it can threaten and affect the shells of marine life.
So can you give us an example of some of the marine life that's affected?
Yeah, so things like oysters, which is what my lab studies, but a lot of other organisms are affected as well, like corals and crabs. A lot of really small organisms in the ocean that we can't see unless we look under a microscope also make shells, and they form the base of the food chain. So there's a lot of organisms in the ocean that are threatened by ocean acidification.
Okay, so when you say that these organisms that have shells are getting affected, is it affecting their ability to make the shell? Are their shells softer? Like what's happening?
Yeah. So there's kind of two parts to it. So just like we tell our kids to drink milk for strong bones because milk has calcium, right? So the marine life gets the calcium from the seawater. So when carbon dioxide diffuses in and it causes this imbalance of ions, it also decreases the amount of calcium ions that are available to those oysters or those shellfish to make their shells. So it's harder for them to make shells. If it becomes too acidic, it can also dissolve their shells once it becomes acidic below a certain threshold.
Wow.
But it's two things. So it's the difficulty to make shells.
Make and the shell in the first place.
The potential for the shells that they do make to dissolve back into seawater.
Oh, so you guys study oysters. So specifically, what do you see with oysters? That is this affecting the population? Like there's less oysters or...
Well, that's something we're really interested in. Often we think of a species as a unit and all of the individuals within that species are an oyster. They're all very similar. But in fact, within oyster populations and almost every species we look at, there's a lot of genetic variability. So that means just like there's variability between people, there's variability between oysters and their ability to deal with different environmental changes.
Very cool. Okay, so you just opened my mind up in that I was thinking that carbon dioxide was bothering the land masses, but we know that Earth is covered with about 70% ocean. So now this carbon dioxide problem is actually a problem for the entire Earth. And the oceans are a bigger problem than what's happening on land because there's more ocean. So does this affect certain areas more than others? Like nations that create more carbon dioxide, are the oceans closer to those nations more affected?
Actually, it's more of a global phenomenon. And this is getting more into like the complexity of the chemistry, which is not my area of expertise,
but Jennifer,
certain areas are becoming acidic at different rates than other areas, but that has more to do with temperature, which affects how carbon dioxide dissolves in the water and the way that other oceanic processes also change acidity, like if there's deep water that upwells into coastal regions.
There are so many factors that play into that.
There's there's a lot of local variation in estuaries where we study oysters. There's variation that is due to freshwater input going into those estuaries as well.
Okay.
And so oysters don't only have to deal with acidification, they are also dealing with changes in salinity, they're dealing with changes in temperature between estuary to estuary. They have to deal with changes in disease pressure for estuary to estuary. And all of these different pressures means that, you know, oysters in one location can adapt to the conditions in those locations a little bit differently than oysters in another location.
Right. Now, that's what you're talking about before. So talk to us a little bit about the genes and the DNA and stuff that you're seeing with how they make these adaptations.
Yeah. So, for example, like I was saying, some oysters are found in freshwater, some are found in saltwater. We find that if we take oysters from a saltwater environment and put them into a freshwater environment, they can't tolerate that environment. So that suggests that there is some adaptive evolution to that freshwater environment. And so what my lab is interested in is to, you know, better understand how species will respond to environmental change in the future. We can use information about how they've adapted to the environments where they're currently found. And so when you compare oysters from a high salinity or low salinity location or a high acidic and low acidic location, this means, and you look at the DNA differences between those oysters, sometimes you see that there are genetic differences. And by genetics, I mean at the DNA level, the blueprint that creates that oyster has a slightly different code at that DNA level in one location where the environment is different from another location.
And you could use all of this to predict what it would be like if some big environmental change happened, and like which ones are going to survive and which ones won't. I mean, really?
It's a very difficult problem.
I won't lie. Not that simple.
It's not quite that simple. You know, to better understand this, we're trying to look at a lot of different traits. So an example in oysters, we might look at how they calcify, like how are they growing? What is their disease load? What are some of the, you know, like molecules that are involved in making the shell? So we look at a lot of traits. And then we also look at their DNA. So we're looking at, you know, what kind of responses is happening in their cells at the DNA level to respond to that environmental change. But you're right, Jennifer, the challenge is still an open challenge. And like, how do we take all of this information to actually make a prediction? You know, we are finding there's a lot of what we call genetic variation. There's definitely individuals that do better and individuals that do worse. And sometimes we can look at some of those traits and some of those areas of their DNA and say, okay, oysters with this genotype might do better at acidification, or oysters with this other genotype, they might be more resistant to disease, or they might do better right. in freshwater. But it's still an open challenge on how we can take all of those individual pieces. It's a puzzle. It's like we have the pieces yeah. for, you know, one kind of stress and another kind of stress, but figuring out how to put all of those pieces together is still an open challenge.
That sounds like a puzzle with a lot of pieces. You're going to need a big table to put that one together. So with all of the different species that are affected by this issue, how did your lab end up focusing on oysters? Is there something about oysters that will tell you more, or are they just prevalent?
So there's a few different things that I think are really cool about oysters. The first thing is they're definitely one of the species that are more susceptible to ocean acidification because of the way they make their shells, especially when they're really small, they're really susceptible to ocean acidification. Another reason is that they are really important for humans and human culture, and oyster fisheries and aquaculture has a really long mm-hmm. history. Some of us love to eat oysters. It's a really popular thing to eat. So there's applications there. And the third reason is that we have a sequenced genome for the oyster. So by genome, I mean that they, just like they've sequenced the human genome, which is all of the DNA in people, right. they've sequenced the genome of the oyster. So we have the blueprint for oysters that we can use now to try to develop these tools for predicting which animals will survive to environmental change.
So you can take an oyster, if you know its DNA genome, its blueprint, and put it in a different environment, and then look at its genome after it's been there for a while and see if it changes and adapts? Is that what you're saying?
Well, yes, but you have to think about adaptation from a population level.
Okay.
So when we talk about evolution, we often think of how populations are changing genetically. A lot of people mistakenly believe that evolution is just about adaptation, but it's actually about any kind of genetic change in a population. And so when it comes to environmental change, we're interested in, can they adapt? So are there some individuals in that population that do better than other individuals? They have more offspring or more kids, the next generation.
Right.
And so that genotype, that type, that genetic type does a little bit better in the next generation. And so we're really interested in, you know, do marine species have this capacity to adapt and change in response to global climate change and other kinds of environmental change and stresses?
That's pretty cool. So you're saying look at it more as a group instead of as an individual.
Yeah.
How many oysters are we talking about here? Like, do you guys work with like hundreds? I mean, you know, what is it?
Yeah. Right now we're in the process of collecting 1,000 oysters from their entire range. So I work on the eastern oyster. They're on the east coast of the US, and they range from Maine all the way down to Florida, and then all the way from Florida over to Texas. There's very different traits between oysters from different parts of the range. For people that like to eat oysters, they know, like, oh, I like to buy oysters from this farm. They taste different from the oysters I buy from this other farm. And they live in these estuaries, which are these nearshore areas where fresh water and salt water meet. And every estuary, like I was saying before, has a very different environment.
Right.
We're right now, we're in the process of surveying oysters from that whole area and characterizing the environments that they live in and characterizing the genomes of those oysters in those environments.
Yeah. Wow. This is, I am from outside of Boston, and I'm imagining all of the number of different oysters that you guys are going to get in that 1,000 sample. And like, my daughter loves going outside and grabbing samples of whether it's rocks or leaves, or her friend across the street likes bugs. She's not quite as much a bug person yet, but I'm imagining like our listeners that are kids that like doing these smaller experiments with maybe 4 or 5 or 6 or 15 rocks, bugs, or leaves in their neighborhood. You're doing this with 1,000 oysters from all the way down the eastern seaboard, around Florida and over to Texas. Yeah. That is a lot of different places to get a lot of different oysters from. That sounds cool.
And we work with a lot of different people across in every state. We're developing collaborations with people across the entire range to get their, you know, every place I think has experts that know a lot about the history of that place. And that kind of knowledge is really important to tap into as a scientist, is get that local knowledge from people that have been working in the area when you're doing these kinds of large scale studies.
So when you go and get these, because you said it's important to get the water and understand what's there, do you collect oysters and bring them back in the water samples so you can sample the water from that area?
There is water data that's available through the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. So just like we have weather data, we have water data.
Yeah.
So we do try to focus on sampling places where there's already data available.
Well, I guess that makes it easier, right? Because then you already know what's there, that you don't have to, that's not part of the mystery you have to solve.
Yeah.
That's helpful. So we've been talking about what you're doing. Are you and your lab approaching any conclusions or answers on are oysters adapting? And aside from fixing the carbon dioxide issue, can we fix the carbon dioxide issue in the ocean? So I suppose that's sort of two much bigger questions.
The first question about some interesting things we're finding in oysters. So, you know, like I was saying before, some of the oysters that we collect do come from very acidic environments, naturally acidic environments in these estuaries where they live. We did one experiment where we exposed adult oysters to ocean acidification. And we raise their offspring in acidic conditions. And we found that their offspring did a little bit better than offspring from oysters whose parents were not exposed to ocean acidification. So this is a really interesting phenomenon.
Yes.
We call it transgenerational inheritance, something about the parents' environment.
Big word.
It's a big word. But it just means that something about the parents' environment is being passed on to the offspring that's allowing them to do a little bit better.
Well, so that sounds a little promising to go back to, can you predict if animals will survive? If you've had, you know, and then I guess you try to raise the offspring to have their own offspring and see if it continues. Is that what you're trying to do there?
Yeah, that's the idea. We're not set up to do that yet, but ideally these carryover experiments would go on for multiple generations. The second part of your question, a little beyond my area of expertise.
Well, that only popped into my head because I actually saw an interview earlier this year with Elon Musk and the XPRIZE, where they give away, I want to say the XPRIZE is like $100 million. It's some ridiculous prize, but it was about removing carbon from the oceans. Yeah. Like that's the current prize right now. And this is the first time I've had a conversation this deep on why that part is important.
Yeah, that's a problem lots of people are trying to solve, I think. I mean, I don't think yet anybody's close to it, but we can always hope. And that's, I think, because you're like, you call yourself the space geek, right? So I love the ocean too. And I think it's interesting that we do so much for space, which is awesome. But there's so much more that we don't know. And we have the possibility of learning about the ocean through, you know, stuff like what Dr. Katie's doing and other scientists.
I was just going to say, like, Dr. Katie mentioning how this is affecting oysters and other animals that are in the ocean. And I know you mentioned crabs as well. I could easily see my 10-year-old daughter being like, oh, no, not the oysters and the crabs. We have to help them. So this is the first time I'm thinking of it in these types of terms. And I honestly wasn't sure if I was at the very beginning of this conversation. I was a little nervous that I wasn't going to understand your marine biology at a level that I was going to get. So I'm glad I do. And I really hope you and everyone working in your lab is really working hard and doing good work.
Well, so my question is do you hope with this, since you're starting with oysters, do you hope to kind of take this and then maybe extrapolate onto other crustaceans and see if they have, I mean, I realize you're only one lab and you can't do everything, but is that the idea?
These principles are even broader than that. I mean, it's not just marine animals that are facing these problems of environmental change. I've also worked in the past with tree biologists, and one problem that tree biologists are facing is, you know, where do we plant trees so they will be pre-adapted to climate change? Yep. Because climate's changing so fast in some places, they want to be able to put trees that are going to grow well because trees grow for 50 years. The climate's going to be different. Oysters is the same problem. Where can we want to do a restoration project. You know, what genotypes, what genetic types should we pick to put in that estuary, given the environment that's there? Yeah. You know, so right now my lab's thinking a lot about how can we build models to better take this genomic information that we have and make a prediction about what genotype is going to do well in what environment. And that kind of problem is has a lot of broad applications.
Oh, yeah.
And these models exist. We're using these models to figure out whose face is in a photo on Facebook and, you know, what product are we going to try to get this person to buy? We're going to advertise to them.
So,
you know, we could take those same kind of models and apply them to these conservation problems, but it's an open area. It's a new line of direction that only a few people are working on right now.
And it's an important one too. I mean, because as you said, it's not, you know, it doesn't appear that the climate change is going to stop anytime soon. It's going to keep changing. And, you know, look at some of the temperatures we've had this year. It's in odd places. In Florida, it's hot, right? Look where I live, it's hot and steamy. But you don't usually get that in the Northwest or in the Northeast, like way up in Maine or something like that. So it's a very interesting problem.
Yeah, and there's hope. These marine species that we work on have huge amounts of genetic variation. And we definitely, like I said earlier, we see that there are individuals that do better in climates that are similar to these future climates. And so, you know, there is hope in that these species will be able to evolve and adapt to mm-hmm. this climate change.
That's good news that there's hope.
That is good
news. I like hearing that. So, now that we have an understanding, hopefully all of our listeners have a better understanding of what Dr. Katie was talking about in terms of looking at the whole group instead of the individuals. Dr. Katie, would you happen to have a challenge that you brought for our listeners that may connect them a little bit stronger to what we've been talking about?
I have a challenge for you. This challenge has two parts. So, okay. To predict which animals survive environmental change, we have to measure a lot of traits, and then we have to understand how those traits interact with the environment. But figuring out how to measure those traits is really challenging. So we need creative new ways to measure lots of traits. Okay. So the first part of your challenge is to develop a system to measure as many traits as possible on Legos or some other group of objects you have laying around the house. Okay. There are a lot of traits you can measure on Legos. You know, for instance, what color is it? How many corners does it have? How tall is it?
Right.
I want to see how many traits you can think of to measure on Legos or another group of objects.
Love it.
After you do that, the bonus challenge is to ask your parents to mimic an environmental change by selecting on one of your Lego traits, but don't let them tell you which one it is. So to select against the Lego traits, your parents will remove all of the Legos with a certain unit of that trait. So for example, they might select against all of the Legos with 8 corners, but they don't tell you that. Your job would then to see, be able to see if you can figure out which trait your parents selected against.
Oh,
this is exactly the kind of puzzle that we try to solve as scientists who are trying to figure out why some animals survive environmental changes and others do not.
I'm guessing it's not as easy as just looking at the corners, though, right? Your job.
But you don't know what they selected on. You have to figure it out.
This sounds like a terrific challenge in that I feel like a lot of our listeners, as soon as they get to the second part where they're having mom and dad do that selection criteria, I don't feel like anybody's going to do this just once.
No,
I think they're going to keep doing this.
It's a different puzzle every time.
Yeah, exactly. Or, you know, like me, the first time it's one trait. The second time you have 2 traits that I've selected. So now you have to figure out one, right?
That's tricky.
That's what happens. That's what happens in nature. You know, we don't know how many traits, we don't know which ones, and, you know, we're trying to figure it out.
It's a mystery.
It is.
What a great challenge that links right up with exactly what it is you described you're doing in your lab.
Yeah.
How cool.
That's very cool. Very cool. Well, this has been a fabulous conversation. I've learned so much, and I always love talking about the ocean. So thanks so much for being on Solve It for Kids, Dr. Katie.
Thank you, Dr. Katie. It was so nice to meet you all.
Wow. So Dr. Katie just did something magical. With her challenge, and I love that it's in 2 parts, with her challenge, she just took a very complex problem that she and her lab scientists are working on and brought it right back down to our kitchen tables with our Legos. This challenge is going to be awesome, and it's going to help us understand the different traits that animals as species have, not just one oyster or a few oysters. What do you think, Jennifer?
I think it was fabulous. And not only that, but I totally want to do this challenge. I think this is going to be so much fun, especially, you know, the more complicated you make it, like I said. But what we hope is that some of our listeners will do this challenge. So if you do this challenge, send us a picture or show us a graph or whatever of the traits that you have. Don't forget, you can tag us on all our social media, which is at KidsSolve at Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. And check out our website, solveitforkids.com, where we'll have more information about Dr. Katie.
That sounds terrific. I am really hoping that we get some listeners that do it with more than just Legos, because she did say that we can do it with any group of objects. So rocks, leaves, toys in your room, whatever it is, do it multiple times and you'll be talking about different traits of all those different types of objects, which is solving problems just like a scientist and Dr. Katie.
Yeah, that sounds so fun. So make sure you guys do that. And then we'll see you next week on
Solve It for Kids.